Solomon the Magnificent, who talks about life under the sun. And he's talking about living in a world where the system is broken beyond repair in this chapter. We have an old saying here. I guess I've never really heard it except down here in the South, but I'll say it's the Southern saying. And that is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That may be incorrect English, but it's great wisdom. But the converse of that old proverb is always troublesome to me. What if it's broken beyond repair? Can it be fixed? And oftentimes, as we look around this world, in fact, as Solomon gazes and muses and thinks about life under the sun, he comes to the conclusion that life is broken beyond repair. You can't fix what's unfixable. And that's what he's talking about in chapter 4. And unfortunately, Solomon realizes that the vast majority of people in this world spend most of their time and energies trying to patch up a system that is destined for decay and destruction. I'm not saying, for those of you who are post-millennial, that we have no hope whatsoever in this world. We certainly do. But it's not in this world, not in a system that is sinful and whose status quo is that which is pitted against God. We have a whole new world called the kingdom of God that Christ ushers in a most wonderful and mysterious way on the wings of grace. It was God who said, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away, and with it all of its lust. But the one who does the will of God, he abides forever." I think Solomon has that truth in mind as he thinks through all of his life and he muses about the things all around him. He sees in this chapter, in these five paragraphs, in chapter 4, five frustrations and great evils that seem to be irreparable in this life. They are, in consequent order, the great abuse of power that hurts innocent people, rivalry and competition that makes everything unpleasant, work that consumes our lives and leaves us little to rejoice over and little purpose to find meaning in, loneliness that is rooted in misplaced values, and the lack of loyalty and support and acceptance and affirmation from the majority of people we know as the public. It is these five great evils that Solomon confronts head on. And I don't want us to be undone by his language. His language is stiff. He's speaking in hyperbolic and exaggerated, purposeful, exaggerated terms. Duane Garrett says, "The candor of his words should not be taken as the musings of a cynic or a suicidal man. He is describing, albeit in hyperbole, the painful situation given to him and others in this life under the sun." He faces head on the things that cause day in and day out frustration for you and me. And I think as Solomon goes through these one at a time, he'll say, you know, this guy must get in the car and go to work to me. He must be looking over my shoulder. He must know my boss. He must know what our government's like, because he's talking about age-old problems in a world that we're always trying to fix up but can't be fixed. Now let's look at these, one paragraph, one truth, one frustration at a time. Solomon talks originally here, and first of all, about oppressive power. Here's what he says in the first three verses of chapter 4. "Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, but that had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, that they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. The better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun." Solomon first bewails the fact of life concerning the abuse of power. That there are people who are in the power elite, the mighty and the influential and the wealthy and the haves as opposed to the have-nots, who do whatever they wish to whomever they wish to maintain the status quo for their good, and no one seems to be able to do anything about it. And he comes to the conclusion, rather cynically, that so many things are done to the poor and the oppressed that better not to be born than to exist. For he realizes that the majority of people born will be born among the little guys, among the people who are the oppressed, rather than the oppressors. And he realizes that power corrupts, and as the American proverb is, nothing corrupts so absolutely as absolute power. And so he says, of all of the things that I've concluded, this may be the most brutal fact in my life. The one who's dead and free from this misery is better than the one who's alive and still suffering in it, and better than both of them is the one who's never been born. I'll remind you of that picture that I painted in your mind. You saw on the front page of the newspapers 6 or 7 weeks ago that little 10 or 11-year-old blonde-haired boy that looked like Stuart Lamb or Nathan or Aaron Ross, sitting there on the heap of the junk pile of what was left in his life, weeping in that place called Kosovo. He was in a refugee convoy under Red Cross protection when our airplanes mistakenly took his relatives for a Serbian military maneuver, and they strafed that convoy, destroying his family and all of his possessions. There he sat, hopelessly pouring out his soul for the whole world with these yells. Thought to myself, but I knew none to bring it. Did the Lord hear about it? Well, I'm sure Milosevic laughed. He probably found it pleasing. Our president said, well, in war mistakes happen. We're sorry. And NATO said, we won't back up. We won't let up. Really, the Serbians are to blame. Which was no comfort to that little boy whatsoever. I must confess honestly, as I saw that photo, I thought of these verses in Solomon, and I said, it would have been better for that little boy never to have been born than to have everything taken from him in one single afternoon. That's what Solomon feels. And he realizes that those who are broken by oppression really can't appeal to the oppressors. These generals and these politicians and these corporate presidents, they deal with policies and trends and statistics, not with people. And those who are the bureaucrats, the executives, they count numbers and not souls. And those who are wealthy and influential, they don't care about anyone but themselves. They believe that they're entitled to all these privileges and powers and positions at the expense of other people. The fact of life is, the more educated and wealthy and powerful we become, the more brutal we are towards the little man and the less he means to us. Why is it like that? Well, I think it's rather simple as we read on in Solomon, which we will over these weeks. Is that if you're going to run with the pack and play with the big boys, you've got to be tough. You've got to be mean. These people play what we call hardball. And if while you're running with the pack, they happen to run over some little people and destroy their lives and shatter them to pieces, there's no time for you to get soft and stop and try to minister to them. The pack will eat you alive. You're going to play with the big boys. You won't play for long if you're not tough. Chuck Swindoll explains it this way. We are inundated with books and seminars and educational courses and motivational speeches on the subject of top-level management and success-oriented leadership. The hype has never been greater, nor the lure more effective. It is easy to get the impression that once one achieves such an impressive status, satisfaction and a great liberating sense of pleasure will be discovered, much like the proverbial pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. The long-awaited dream, however, is more often than not a distressing, ridden nightmare. Instead of finding relief and companionship, the chief executive officer has a head-on collision with reality, and with anxiety and pressure, jealousy and politics, ruthless decisions, economic headaches, and inescapable loneliness at the top. Solomon says, I look around and I see myself. There's none with power like I have. And I think of all the little people I've brought over in my life as king. And I realize that there was no one to comfort them. But then I realize, what else could I have done? I was victim of senseless hiding. You see, that's the second great tradition, the second great evil, senseless rivalry in verses 4, 5, and 6. And I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is a war between man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh, but one hand full of rest is better than two-fifths full of labor and striving after wind. Solomon said, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is rivalry. That's how it literally reads in Hebrew. It is rivalry. This senseless competition that drives our labors and misappropriates our skills and causes us not to enjoy our work, but to compete, to compete, to compete. And all that the evil of inhumane oppression yields, so much worse the inhumane competitiveness that drives us, so that we instinctually, like animals, grabbing for more and biting and devouring for bigger and better and nicer, rather than thinking through who we are and why we're here. Trevor Longman says that this word kenna, the word for rivalry, is really the word for envy, envy of one's neighbor. He says Kovalev sees only these selfish motives, getting ahead of one's neighbor behind all of our work. This motive can never be satisfied, and so it leads to ceaseless work and despair and utterly to loneliness in the soul. It's what Solomon writes in the Proverbs when he says, "The tranquil heart is life to the body, but rivalry is rottenness to the bones." We have this sense of the superlative in life. We no longer enjoy anything just for the sake of the moment. We no longer find contentment. We have to have more. We no longer find satisfaction in what God gives us. We have to have better. It's no longer that we have enough. We want the most, the best, the biggest, the shiniest, the sweetest. It's like John D. Rockefeller was asked about a century ago, "Mr. Rockefeller, how much is enough?" And he answered quickly without thinking for a split second, "Oh, always just a little bit more." That's how we think. Everything, Solomon said, is ruined by competition. We've got to have the biggest churches and the best teams and the lion's share of the market and the nicest house and the most degrees and the slickest car. It's always in the superlative. I know you'll say, "Oh, really?" But let me use my favorite illustration as an illustration. Those Buckeyes in Ohio State. Now, let me just tell you what they've accomplished this year athletically. We don't go to school up there. We just go to ball games. They finished number 2 in the nation in football, number 4 in basketball. They just lost the baseball game this afternoon, or they would have gone to the College World Series and been in the top 8 in baseball. They finished in the top 8 in hockey, went to the hockey playoffs. Their ladies' basketball team went to the NCAA tournament, and they won 6 other national championships in minor sports this year. You think that will keep the people in Columbus happy? Not for a second. They're still whining up there, "When's the next time we're going to win a national championship?" And they've already won 6 in football alone. People can never be satisfied. You can never do enough, accomplish enough, own enough, please enough, because there's always the desire for just a little bit more. Solomon says, what's the result? It's burnout. The folding of hands, rest. Better one handful of rest than 2 fistfuls of labor in striving after wind. This endless drive to be the biggest and the best, to win, to do better, to take it all, to achieve last year's accomplishments, to do better than my father did, to have a bigger house than my grandfather had, in the end wears us out, leaves us empty inside. And yet, you know what? Solomon says that's not the worst charity in life. Barry Kidner is right when he says, "If anything can be more tyrannous than envy, that thing is habit, when habit has turned into fixation." In verses 7 and 8, picture the compulsive moneymaker as someone virtually dehumanized, where he has surrendered to a mere craving and to the endless process of feeding that craving. That's the next great evil Solomon focuses on, compulsive work. The guy who is the workaholic, the miser who drives himself and hoards everything, and never stops to ask the reason why. Verses 7 and 8. "And then I looked again at vanity under the sun, and there was a certain man without a descendant, having neither a son nor brother. Yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, 'And for whom am I laboring in depriving myself of pleasure?' This too is vanity, and it is a grievous task." Here's the classic description of the workaholic. A man driven by his work, a slave to his job. This particular fellow is especially sad, because the Hebrew says, "There was one, but not a second." The New American Standard says, "I looked and there was a certain man without a descendant," but that phrase really literally reads, "There was one, but not a second." Which means that this man had no wife, no mother and father alive, no siblings, no children, no cousins, no friends. He worked and lived for himself. A man whose kin was his job, he was married to his work. And he was driven to earn and to invest and to build and to accumulate in this mindless aberration of what a human being is supposed to be. And he never stops to ask the question, Solomon says, and so then by laboring in depriving myself of all this pleasure, he just stopped and thought about himself for a moment. He'd say, why am I working so hard? Why do I accumulate more and more and never take the time to enjoy what I've got? I don't have a wife to leave it to and no children. I don't have any brothers and sisters where I can establish a trust fund for my nieces and nephews for generations to come. I don't have a church or an organization that I'm committed to or even friends that I could pass it out to. I have no one. Just my work. And yet I work harder to gain more and more all the time. R.N. Winebury says, the case I had to hear is that of a rich man who spoke that he might not burden the grippers by getting it. This man, he became the miser. He says, Solomon does, if this man would just stop for a minute, just stop, and ask this question, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? He'd lock the door of the office, go to his house, and begin to build a home. The sad thing about this fellow, or this woman for that matter, is that you work for them all the time. They're the ones that can never have you work enough and do enough. They don't have any life outside of work, and so they drive you to the dogs. The sad thing is that I believe they will stop someday and ask that question. For whom am I laboring? And why have I deprived myself of all life's pleasures? But then it will be too late. They'll be on the age to be married and find a true love. Their years of child-rearing and enjoying children will be gone. They will have no kinfolk to whom to leave this massive trust that they have, no friends that will share their old age with them, even talk about the memories of their big acquisitions and mergers and all their successes. They'll be alone. And they'll realize it, and they'll hate it. And that is what they're destined for the rest of their days, to be alone. Because, you see, when other men were settling down and driving those old junky cars in order to put kids through college and living in little houses for the retirement home later on, they were not. They were getting it all right now and amassing more and more of it. And I think the real reason they're like that is rather pitiful. There are people who are afraid of people. They're lonely people, but they're afraid to risk being involved with people. And so, they are committed, even condemned, to this vicious cycle of life, to work as a lonely miser, only to be lonely in your misery the rest of your days. They'd rather talk to a computer than talk to someone else. They'd rather risk an investment than risk the love relationship with someone of the opposite sex. They'd rather take all of their time to invest in stuff rather than invest in the family. They love their work. The only problem is their work will never love them back. And so they end up lonely. And they're not just pagans who do this. Listen to Gordon Cady, a PCA pastor. It is well to remember that Koheleth was speaking to the people of God. Yes, it is very possible for Christians to throw themselves into dysfunctional patterns of life. Devoted pastors have sacrificed their families on the altar of an exaggerated and unbalanced view of their calling in church. Christian businessmen can enjoy making money and find it a bit easier than the work of forging a healthy home life and a loving patient cooperation and relationship with a wife and children. And some men live all their lives as if they were bachelors to the eternal frustrations and poverty of their wives and children. You want to know what film critics, what filmmakers call the greatest film of all time? It's not Gone with the Wind. That'll surprise you. It's called Citizen Kane. You ever seen it? It's about a man who, all of his life, was searching for something. The movie begins with this man who's dying, played by Orson Welles. And on his deathbed, all of the people like vultures are around him to see who's going to get his billion, and he utters one word, Rosebud. And so the whole movie is about trying to find out who Rosebud is. And we go back over his life. We start from his old age and go back to his childhood. And we find this man who was driven in search of something, ambitious, a workaholic, a successful man. A man who had a perfect track record and that everything he touched became gold and everyone he touched ended up hating him. He went through marriages and friends and deep relationships. And in the end of his life, all alone in this room full of priceless treasures, literally stacked in heaps, he utters the word Rosebud. We find only in the end of the movie that Rosebud is a little snow sled that he had when he was a little boy, about the time that his mother died and his father left and the love of his family dissolved. All of the things he searched for in life could be summed up in one thing, some little toy that reminded him of a day when he had the love of a family that was a priceless treasure. Something he looked for all his life, but died filthy rich and awfully much alone, crying out for Mama. Solomon says such is the ultimate legacy of a workaholic and a miser. He works alone. He dies alone. He leaves it all to no one. And he's a person who may be surrounded by a lot of people, and yet he's lonely. That's the fourth thing that Solomon talks about. Something that seems like an oxymoron, I call it social loneliness. Look at it. Verses 9 through 12. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. Now I want you to notice something about this little paragraph, these four verses. Solomon presents this problem of loneliness differently than he does the other four problems he talks about. In all the other occasions, he says, I saw a man, or I knew a fellow, or I thought about this person. But here he does not personify in any personal way loneliness. In fact, he really doesn't ever talk about loneliness. He doesn't mention the word. Why not? Well, I think because Solomon can realize that he was one of those power brokers who ran over the little guy and gave no comfort to the suffering that he caused. He was one of those men who was a competitive man, always wanted more and finer and bigger and better, newer stuff, and got it. He was a miser, a workaholic who sacrificed his family in order to build a kingdom that he left to no one. The one thing he has a very difficult time admitting is that he was a lonely man. He won't come out and say it. But that is exactly what he's talking about. He talks about it euphemistically. In fact, he presents it in positive terms. He knows that here's a man who has 1,000 women, 700 wives, and 3,000 concubines, but no one true love of his life. A man whose household retinue and entourage numbered in the hundreds, who is surrounded by ongoing parties and banquets. He had people like the Queen of Sheba and the King of Tyre and Sidon and all these people coming to see him. Pharaoh wanted him to marry his daughter. He was surrounded by thousands of people all of the time. He was never without people and incredibly popular. And he was alone. And all of those people, he was alone. And he says, I realize that there are four values, four great benefits associated with friendship and partnership. And here they are. A good return. A good return. Not a return. A good return for one's labor. Verse 9. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. They don't just get stuff. They share things. Secondly, when trouble comes, they have help. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up, whether that fall is physically or spiritually. Thirdly, there's warmth and comfort, both physical and emotional. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one warm alone? Finally, he realizes that there's strength in friendship, both in adversity and against adversaries. And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. Solomon, in musing over his life, realizes that in all the things he's done, there are two things he's failed to do. He'll talk about it in the next chapter. He said, I have known 1,000 men, and maybe one is a friend. I've known 1,000 women, and not one is a true love. I think perhaps he's thinking about the book of Genesis, and the very first time that God speaks, a nation of a man was built, and thought that was around all these people. Constantly around people, and always alone. You know, Billy Graham wrote a book a few years ago. And in the opening sentence of the opening chapter, he said this: if loneliness were a sickness, it would be America's number one disease and the greatest, most deadly killer in the industrialized, modern Western world. Loneliness. Solomon, for all that he had, never had anyone to cuddle with. You men know what that's like. You cuddle up to your wife. One of those hairpins you wear just goes in one ear and it's agonizingly painful, but you figure, what else is there in life? You know what it is to sit down and talk to a friend, someone that doesn't expect you to always put on a smiling face and take praise of the Lord and have all the right answers? You can be honest with them, and they can say, how are you today? And you say something that I can't repeat in the pulpit. You know what it is? To be so lonely and so broken and so hurt that you just can't say anything. But there are people in life you can go to and just weep in their presence be the right answer. They just weep with you and put their arms around you. Solomon had no one like that. We know loners. And loners are people who, for the moment, prefer to be that way. They never like being like that when they're older. But we know other people who have lots of friends. They never seem to be alone. And yet they're lonely. And you would be surprised in your circle of friends who are socially tight, who always have a lot of things to do. They're always on the phone and always having lunch and, you know, they're always doing lunch and doing this. They're always with somebody, but you know what? They're lonely. Because you can be around a lot of people, lots of people, and never be around a true friend. Lord Francis Bacon said, to find a friend, you must be one yourself. For no receipt will open the heart but a true friend, to whom you may impart griefs and joys and fears and hopes, suspicions, counsels, and whatsoever lies in the deepest regions of a heart to appease it. We know that Solomon was a man who knew a lot of people, and a lot of people wanted to know him. But he tells us here, if we read between the lines, he was a lonely man. Oh, let us ponder well the deep responsibility of our social obligation. Are we discharging them as unto the Lord for the honor of His name and for the edifying and increase of His church? Did we but pray for each other as we ought, what a brotherhood would be the family of man. The time is short. Opportunities are passing us away. Happy those who have been fellow helpers upon earth and who have those helpers themselves. They shall rejoice before their gracious Lord with joy unspeakable, uninterrupted, without abatement, without end, and always in the presence of friends. But Solomon warns us that friendship is not the same thing as popularity. This man was popular. And he talks lastly and fifthly about the fickle popularity that is such a seduction in this life. Verses 13 to 16. A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. He has come out of prison to become king, even though he was poor in his kingdom. I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. There is no end to all the people, to all who were before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be happy with him. For this too is vanity and striving after wind. Here's the first, the fifth and the last of the great frustrations that make up the parameters of this broken world, and that is, you can never trust the crowd. You know what we call them. It's all those people. They never seem to have a face. They're just out there. All those people. All those people who set the trends, and all those people that tells what we all do, all those people that are always upset, and all those people that are always trying to please, even though we don't know who they are. And they don't care who we are. And Solomon presents it this way. He said, I know an old king. I wonder who he's thinking about. I know an old king who had a great track record and the people loved him. He was a good king for all of his failures. But then he got old and a little senile, a little fixed in his way, as elderly folks do. And he wasn't as open to change, and so the people went and found someone else. They found an ex-con, a bum, an unemployed welfare check-gathering scumbag. But he had to get to the golden tongue. He talked about what he would do if he was in charge. Even though this king had served this people and been their leader for over 40 years, they took the young buck, the old guy out of office, and put him in. But you know what? By the time their children were able to vote, they threw the young man out too. And such is the cycle of popularity with the public. Solomon says, there is no end to all the people. To all who were before them, and even to the ones who will come later, will not be happy. This fickle public, this crowd, let's not call them the crowd, the public, let's call them what they are. They're the mob. And they're only good for one thing, Solomon said. That's for being disgruntled and throwing someone else in. And they never really think about what you've done for them, your track record, your accomplishments. They don't really think about patience or forgiveness or trust. They have one thing they consistently say, what have you done for me today? And Solomon says, if you spend all your life, I know, you're going to be, I know, these two rogues belong in the same category. James Dobson tells us this, that one in every four pastors in America will be fired at least once in an average career of 30 years of pastoral ministry, at least once. Two out of every three pastors will lead at least one church under duress, what we call being run off. 60% of all of the men in the ministry today will not retire in the ministry. They will meet a premature death, illness, firing, or they'll just quit because of discouragement. The American Medical Association tells us that the worst health risk and the worst health insurance rating is found among all professions is that of ministers because of stress. And all it takes, brethren, is one unpopular policy, one wrong decision, one power broker disgruntled, and you're gone. We always keep our bags packed. People ask me all the time, you're going to be here a long time at Trinity, and they never like my answer because it's evasive. I tell them this, I'll be here as long as God leaves me, and the majority votes yes. And that's what Solomon's saying. You can't look for the public to tell you who you are and whether you're doing okay, whether you're a good fellow. They can't be trusted. Look what he said. For this too is vanity, and it's striving after wind. This popularity is like chasing the wind. Walter Kaiser says, how fleeting and altogether temporary is the popularity that is accorded men. What does it matter if a man has even royal blood, royal power, or royal record? In one case, the old king, although born to the throne, becomes foolish and senile and unable to discern that his days of ruling are over. And in another situation, a young but poor wise man may rise from prison to the throne, yet such are the constant ups and downs of life, although the young man was welcomed and popular at first, he too will no doubt share his predecessor's fate and be thrown away like all the rest. Solomon said, what the Dutch say, this is a Dutch proverb, he who serves the public serves the most fickle master. And Solomon said, I've worked for the public all my life. And I've had it up to here. And I know that a lonely man can find no comfort or friend in the mob. Well, that's the paradigm of a system that's broken that can't be fixed. And you would think if we stop there, which we will right now, that Solomon was saying it's really not worth living. But that's not what he's saying whatsoever. If we read on, we'll find that he talks about power abuse and rivalry and compulsive workers and loneliness and the public. That he takes a different slant on things, and here's ultimately what he says. He says, I realize that most people who have power will abuse little people and never care about them, and no one will cover them, but there's always the chance that you have a little opportunity, even a small one, a little influence, a little wealth, small position, to do something for somebody to make their life a little more comfortable and give them a little more comfort in life. And competition, that's a bad thing. And as you get older, you'll probably think less about competing and more about cooperating. And you realize that God has really, in His system, given us enough of everything to go around so everybody has enough. Thirdly, your work is meaningless unless you have two things to nail it down with purpose. A calling from God and someone you can point to that you're helping with that work. Otherwise, you need to ask yourself, why am I doing what I'm doing? And why is it so unpleasurable? Fourthly, your life has got to make time for people. People who count. Your family. Your friends. Genuine spiritual callings. Colleagues. Because a man who dies with no real friends dies a failure and dies poor. And lastly, you will always have to fight against the urge to please the phantom known as all those people. But that's all they are. They're just a phantom. They're just a bunch of people abused by power, lonely in the crowd, unfulfilled in their work, wanting just a little bit more. You'll never please them. Don't try. Solomon is going to tell us that we have two choices in this life, and the choices are ours. Frustration or power. And if your life's purpose is just to gain power, to hold on to position, to get stuff for reasons you don't know why, for people you don't care about, then you're going to be a frustrated person. And I am a miser. But it can also be fulfilling. If you realize that the purpose of your life is to care for other people and to get things that you can give them, not to gain but to share, and that the joy in the journey is working with other people to make things a little bit better, even in this broken world that will never be totally fixed until Jesus Christ comes back again. Solomon tells us we've got to start thinking not about power, but about compassion. Not about winning, but about sharing. Not about work, but about service. Not about selfishness and stuff, but about the risk of loving others. Not about what everybody thinks, but what God wants from our life and our time in this life under the sun. It wasn't too long ago that we had a friend of mine visit us here in Jackson. I've known him for 28 years. I hadn't seen him for 15 years. He came to church one day, drove all the way from Baton Rouge to see us, to meet the family. Never met my children, although he met Jane. And he came to church, and then he came to lunch with the new members, the inquirer's class, to our house as we received new members and entertained them that day. And this fellow and I, our lives began the same way, but they took radical turns in the road. He had a life in the fast lane, moved to California. He was the president of a number of high-tech companies and a world traveler. He traveled from Paris to Munich to Tokyo about 3 or 4 times a year, made the cycle. He was involved in major mergers and acquisitions. He had a computer in his lap, and he told me he had a computer terminal in every room of his house. In fact, the 2 hours he was at his house, he made 5 long-distance phone calls and sent 3 faxes over my telephone. I never knew my telephone was that high-tech. He ended up with a failed marriage and 2 kids in therapy and no Jesus Christ. As he packed up all the high-tech stuff, went on to Philadelphia to talk about the next merger, turned to look at me and my family in our living room with tears in his eyes, this is what he said. He said, "It's been good to see you again, my friend. Listen to this. I only wish that I could have your family, your church, and your faith in Jesus Christ. That's really all I want." And I said, "Robert, you can have all that. But there's some things you've got to let go of to grab hold of Jesus Christ. The choice is yours." And that's what Solomon is saying. This system we live in for now, my loved ones, is broken. But that doesn't mean that your life needs to be shattered to pieces by it. Not so. And don't say for a moment, better never to have been born than to live like this. Because there's always tomorrow. Always a new day. And look at Jesus Christ. Look how He lived in this broken world and look what He accomplished. He was never a power broker, although all power was given to Him. He was a compassionate man. He was never a man who gathered a whole lot. He was always giving away, wasn't He? He spent time knowing what God called Him to do and why He was doing and for whom He was to lay down His life. His work had purpose. He had a few close friends, 12 of them, and a tight family. And He really never cared what the crowd would. He knew they'd crucify Him, deliver Him under the hands of death, as He died for the mob. And what would we be like if Jesus Christ had never been born under the sun? Life is broken beyond repair for now. But that doesn't mean it's purposeless, meaningless, and fruitless. It is not. Life is a wonderful thing. If you know why you're here, and who you serve, and why you're suffering and why you suffer, and you love the right kinds of people, you have a mob, heart that is living for a heavenly purpose in this life under the sun, makes all the difference between frustration and fulfillment. Let's pray. Lord God, we know that this Solomon was a wise man. And part of his wisdom was looking at his own life and finding the things that he had done that were mistaken and foolish so that he could teach us about the failures of his own life. We could learn from them. We pray that we would learn these things. We would begin to take a different look at our work. Look at why we do the things we do and for whom we're giving up all of our pleasures. What is the calling in our life? What did Jesus want us to do? Help us to be less competitive and more cooperative. Less concerned about winning and more concerned about sharing. Help us to transition from work to service, from drudgery to purpose, from frustration to fulfillment, to risk loving other people, and to never invest in all those people who really mean nothing to us, but mean everything to You. Make us servants in this world with the joy of salvation. And now as we go to the Lord's table, strengthen us for this purpose and comfort us in this hour. And help us to find joy in our work, in our labors, in our life, in this broken world, under the sun, graced and blessed by the very presence of God in our flesh. This Lord Jesus Christ, in whose name and for whose sake we now pray. Amen.